Will we see greater gender equality within our lifetimes? What is the role of men and boys in the future of leadership? And how do we address domestic violence? Big questions that we're deep diving into with Georgette Tan, president of United Women Singapore, who previously headed up communications and CSR at Mastercard Asia Pacific. In this episode, we're deep diving into the need and struggle to change the mindsets around women's roles, challenging the patriarchy in leadership, the importance of women in sustainability, and the five S's to keep you sane. It's time to live wide awake. Hey, it's Duff Dixon, and welcome to the podcast. Here, we get into the minds of some of the most conscious humans around the world to understand how our actions affect our mental well-being, happiness, and the planet. Because self and planetary healing is really an inside-out job. So let's unpack this human experience together so that we can live wide awake. Georgette Tan is the president of United Women Singapore, an NGO advocating gender equality and women's empowerment by building the pipeline of future women leaders through education, economic empowerment, and advocacy. She also sits on the board of SCWO, Singapore Council of Women's Organization, and is chair of Board Agenda, an initiative focused on increasing the number of women in board positions. Previously, she was senior vice president communications, heading up communications and CSR at Mastercard Asia Pacific. Prior to joining Mastercard, Georgette was vice president of communications at CNBC Asia and Dow Jones Asia, and also held senior communication roles at the Hong Kong Trade Development Council and Singapore Tourism Promotional Board. Well, Georgette, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about your life journey and also the incredible work that you're doing right now. So I'm really appreciative of your time. I'd love to start with sharing a little bit about your 21-year career in the corporate world and what it was like at Mastercard for over two decades.
Well, actually, it was just shy of 20 years, about a little close to 19, but it was a fabulous career, and I've been blessed in that. I've worked for both the public sector as well as the private sector, and I took early retirement from Mastercard, but I was there for close to 19 years and doing a couple of different roles in communications across the region, working with the global team. And as part of the remit, I also had a chance to initiate and launch and spearhead and manage the CSR function within the Asia Pacific region.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, when I was looking at your LinkedIn profile and I saw like 19, 20 years at the same company, I was like, wow, I just feel like I don't think I would know anyone at this level now when people are in their careers that would be at the same company for like almost two decades.
Well, unfortunately, this says how old I am, though.
But I guess I'm just so curious, like you obviously were really felt like you were part of the company and that you were progressing and everything, you know, so you never felt tempted to kind of go to a different company. You really just wanted to continue climbing the corporate ladder at Mastercard?
Very, very much the case. I think there was always so much to do. And clearly, it was a very innovative sector. It was a sector that was booming between, you know, payments, card payments, alternative payments, innovation, all the tech, the fintech space. It was constantly growing. This whole region, the Asia Pacific region, of course, is a very dynamic region. So managing communications across the region was both fun, but also challenging at times. And it was a constant learning experience. And I will say what keeps a person in any role within an organization certainly are the people that you get to work with. And I was very fortunate in that I got to work with some of the best in the industry and certainly within Mastercard itself. And I have to say, till today, I consider many of them my friends, my mentors, ex-colleagues, and I love keeping in touch with them.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. I think people make all the difference in the world. So I was curious, as a woman who was in a really important leadership position, what were some of the struggles that you faced? Because I think this then, I'm guessing, and I guess we're going to dive into this sort of then linked to all the work that you're doing now post Mastercard. So I was just wondering, especially during that time, you know, you would have really been part of, I guess, the push and the fight to have more women in leadership in over those almost 20 years.
You're absolutely right, Steph. When I first started at Mastercard, there weren't that many women in senior leveled roles, or certainly not heading up business units or driving businesses, particularly profit loss type P&L functions. And MasterCard was certainly one of the more progressive organizations. And I did see that grow over time. And I was very heartened by the fact that certainly at meetings, I would see more women. I would see greater diversity, certainly, sitting at the table, or certainly in the key support functions, you know, that were one step down, right? So I think that was a process. I consider myself very lucky in that I did head up the women's strategy at MasterCard across Asia Pacific. And that meant getting involved in everything from research to the internal communications piece to employee engagement, and then looking at CSR and how, you know, the community outreach that we were able to do across all the markets that MasterCard operated in. So that certainly helped build our presence. That certainly helped, I think, differentiate MasterCard from the other players in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you feel like you were very supported because you said it was quite progressive, or did you feel at the time that you really had to fight for positioning and for supporting the other women?
I personally was fortunate in that I didn't have to fight, though that being said, I do know for a fact that there were others, particularly in some of the other markets across the region and certainly across the world, not just in Asia Pacific, some of my female colleagues who felt very challenged, who felt that they were either, they weren't supported as they should have been, they didn't see the progression ahead of them, and they weren't perhaps given as many opportunities as they would have liked to have had. So yes, it wasn't an even playing field.
What do you think now of the situation? You know, do you think it's more even? Because I still think there's quite a lot of inequality when it comes to leadership positions and around the world as well. You know, I mean, not just in Asia, but I think it's still not quite where it should be. What do you think?
You're absolutely right. I think there has been some progress, albeit very slow, glacier-like, in fact, some people might say. You know, the numbers, I certainly know that there are industries, there are organizations that pride themselves in making the move in the right direction, that they are working towards 50-50 split across the board, not just at the lower levels, and really working to get middle and senior management positions filled by women. I think perhaps it's at the highest level that we see the struggle. And certainly even at the board levels, I think at the board table, that's even more pronounced. So I chair an initiative here in Singapore called Board Agenda, which really looks at advocating, supporting more women into board roles, getting women board ready. And this is not just at commercial entities, not just at publicly listed companies, but within government agencies, nonprofits, small businesses, family businesses. I think having a women get a seat at the board table is something that we work to strive to attain. And again, the numbers vary, but here in Singapore, it ranges between 18% for publicly listed companies on the Singapore Exchange. But at the nonprofit sector level, it's probably like 27 to 28%. And similarly for government agencies, about 28% are women. So there's still a struggle. There's still a need to change mindsets over time. It's a demand supply situation. I think having the pipeline of women who are ready to step up into the role and take their seats at the table, whether it is at the board table or at senior management level, having that steady pipeline is one area. The other area is the demand. It's the mindset, changing the mindsets of whether it's the chairman, the family patriarch, the nominating panels on boards, making sure that they ensure that when they do replace director at board level, they always consider a woman, the woman is on a slate, and that they really look out for the best person who can fill that position.
So just diving deeper a little bit on the mindset aspect, I'm curious about that. So where do you think the mindset shift really comes from? Is it more from internal pressures? Is it more from external pressures? What are some of the levers that you've seen where things start to actually shift in the mind?
Good question. How much time do you have? We could go on forever. I think there's certainly an internal push. I think there's an opportunity, especially with the new generations taking over within family businesses, right? Recognizing that there is a generation of very capable women who have the right skill sets, the right attributes to be able to step into a position to take a role either at senior level management or at the board. So internally, that started to happen. How quickly that's happening? Well, that's, I think, the issue for us. It's not happening quickly enough. But there are also factors that go beyond that. So there are some regulatory guidelines, and we're seeing this around the world, where there are external factors like these days, many of the investment companies, many of the banks, are saying that when they invest in a company, they want to make sure that the board is a diverse board, that they want to ensure that there's a strong female representation on the board. So that's one of the external pressures. The same thing goes very often for banks and their loans that they put forward and access to finance. So again, when they look at companies before they decide whether to provide access to financing, they certainly look at the composition and board representation. And gender, I believe, is very much front and center for them these days. So I think that's a strong factor that comes into play. But there are also regulatory factors. After a certain number of years, publicly listed boards should definitely, in fact, all boards should look, as part of strong governance, good governance, they should look at moving older board directors off and making way for new blood. That's where the opportunity lies for these very capable women who are now waiting and in that pipeline.
Yeah, no, that's really encouraging to hear, especially about the banks. I didn't know that. I think that's it's good to hear that it's a team effort in that sense, and that there are regulations, and
it is an ecosystem, yeah. Literally. Yes, very much so.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm curious, once you left MasterCard and you said you had early retirement, what was the transition then to go so deeply into the nonprofit work? Because I feel like all the stuff that I know you're doing, you're working so much still. So it's not exactly retirement, is it?
It's a different type of work, certainly. And I was fortunate in that while I was at MasterCard, I was already deeply entrenched in the space of the nonprofits. I was, you know, in CSR. I had already started to sit on boards in the nonprofit space. And that was really where I found, you know, I was passionate. That's where I determined. I jumped out of bed every morning, certainly, you know, with that kind of gusto that said, this is what I want to do. So yes, it wasn't that difficult. And I have to say, the nonprofit space these days, unlike your very traditional, old-fashioned, I'm a charity, I'm going to wait for someone to come and give me money, I think here you're seeing the shift. Even the nonprofits, the not-for-profits, that the NGOs are starting to take on a different business model. I think we have to. If we want to stay competitive, if we want to stay ahead of the game, if we want to ensure that we are differentiated and that we get support. And support here, it's not just the financial support and the donations and the contributions, but support by way of even volunteers. It's a very competitive space in that respect. It's very cluttered. Everybody has a lot of choice as to what they want to support, what cause they want to follow. So we have to ensure that we differentiate ourselves and we are able to tell our story. We are able to articulate clearly what we are trying to do, who our beneficiaries are, how the funds and contributions are spent responsibly, obviously, yes, and what it is that makes how we have impact. That's critical. So on the one hand, the back end, everything to do with governance, everything to do with accountability, transparency, that hasn't changed, right? That's really, really tight. that functions truly integrated fashion. What has changed is the external approach, because it's about looking and ensuring partnerships are front and center, looking at understanding and valuing volunteers for the skills that they bring to us. And we are nothing without our partners. So that's where I think the shift has taken place over the years.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's the same with us at Green is New Black. Partnerships and community and collaboration have been the entire reason that we exist today.
Absolutely.
What you were sharing, it kind of seems like it wasn't always that way in the nonprofit sector. So you're saying that now things are done differently and things are approached differently. So it is more of a partnership and collaboration opposed to...
Yes, I think certainly the sense that partners and the need to market oneself need to communicate and to be out there and to be proactive rather than sit back and wait for someone to come and make a donation. That's, I think, where the difference lies. And I think certainly that, again, this recognition that there are all kinds of different partners, whether it's with a financial contribution, a donation, an organization that wants to partner us to provide us content, a partner who wants to come and bring us volunteers because these are their employees and it's part of their employee engagement, or individuals, right? Students. And we value each and every one of them for the skill sets that they bring to us because they give us their most valuable asset, time.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about your advocacy work now. So you obviously do a lot to accelerate female empowerment and anti-violence efforts. And also maybe you can share a little bit more about your role as president of United Women Singapore.
I'm happy to. Thank you for the opportunity, Steph. So United Women Singapore is a locally registered organization here in Singapore. We are a nonprofit. And our focus is that of gender equality, women's empowerment, and as I like to say, we build a pipeline of future women leaders. And we do so in a variety of different ways. Clearly, it's all about empowerment, but how we get there, because to us, education is key. Education at all different levels is key. So one of the main areas of focus for us is our flagship program. It's called Girls to Pioneers, and it's really a STEM program. It's science, technology, engineering, and math, encouraging girls to take STEM subjects in school. And certainly we believe that by doing so, it opens up opportunities for them at, you know, when they move on to junior college and university and college, and it opens up choices for them into their careers, from their first jobs into later on, or for that matter, if it's not employment, it could be entrepreneurship and they may want to start their own business. But a strong STEM base, we believe, helps to level the playing field. And certainly where we see the future jobs lie, everything is, whether it's med tech, agri tech, everything around sustainability and environment is all tech related and innovation related. So the STEM foundation is really critical. I say that, and at the same time, I will interject that we also believe that to ensure a well-rounded education, we believe the A is very important too. So the addition of the A for standing for arts. So it's not just STEM, it becomes STEAM, right? And here arts, not just poetry and painting and sculpture, but arts in the approach, in also the aspect around 21st century competencies, around things like communication, critical thinking, leadership, problem solving, collaboration. All those aspects help layer on over the STEM foundation. And we believe that that will certainly level the playing field and provide the girls actually the confidence that they need to succeed. So that's one area that we focus on. We've got this flagship program that we've run now for 8 years. It's a great program. We've been growing it, adding to the curriculum, looking at, again, new areas. The areas of future job, the industries, certainly around, again, sustainability, climate change, clean energy, all those areas, and getting girls excited about what they can be doing and the difference that they can be making in these areas. We started a part of the program where we bring them out to meet role models. We bring them, we, this is pre-pandemic, of course, we were able to bring them out to for corporate visits. And they could see firsthand, you know, exciting things happening, whether it's 3D printing, whether it's data at use, whether it's R&D, whether it's innovation, the tech behind everything. And it was fascinating. The girls loved it. We've had to, because of ever since last year, because of the pandemic, we've gone online like everybody else. That's changed our program slightly. It's not quite the same. We miss the face-to-face interactions. We miss seeing the girls, you know, and their faces light up when they get the answers, when they figure things out. But, you know, we make do, and certainly we still soldier on and reach out to the girls right across. I mean, these are girls in the schools. These are girls, homeschooled girls, girls in the madrasas here in Singapore. It's just so encouraging when you see the girls and their faces light up when they get the experiments, when they do the models and they get the answers and they get the results. And they know it's right. This sense of accomplishment, the sense of success, but the confidence that comes with it is just, it's wonderful. That's an area that we're really, really focused on. And we can intend to build on that over the years and invest in it for that matter too. So that's one area, Steph. And the other area you rightly pointed out is really addressing the issue of domestic violence. Because we know that that's something that unfortunately happens around the world. And the pandemic has just exacerbated the situation. You know, between lockdowns, between, you know, families holed up in small apartments, children being homeschooled, you know, family members losing their jobs or being furloughed. So the economic stress and financial stress that comes about, unfortunately, has meant that we're seeing more instances of domestic violence. So that's where we're spending a lot of our time and effort too.
Mm. And so how do we help in that instance, you know, or how do you really even measure the impact of what's actually happening? And what does that work look like to help women who are in that situation?
So this is where we're partnering with the government agencies and other grassroots organizations here. And the space that we are working in is really in the corporate space. Because of our network of corporate partners, we actually developed a program, we call it GenSafe. It's a foundational program that we work with our partners and other organizations and chambers of commerce, where we help their HR departments, we help their line managers and their senior management understand the issue. Many of these corporates, even the most enlightened and forward-thinking organizations, have programs and HR policies that deal with sexual harassment on site. But many of them don't know how to deal with it. They certainly don't have policies that work towards what happens when one of their employees comes into work and they suspect that this employee may in fact be a victim of domestic violence, or possibly a perpetrator of domestic violence. So there are all kinds of issues about how to deal with it, how to recognize it in the first instance, how to respond appropriately, and how to refer the situation to the right authorities to provide the right assistance to their employees. So it is, you know, we like to think of it, it's both a personal issue, but it's also a personnel issue for organizations.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I wanted to circle back to the STEM research as well, because you mentioned previously that you had actually done a lot of interesting research around girls in Singapore in STEM, and maybe you can share a little bit about what you uncovered.
I love research. So this is the best part. You know, and again, we start with the research and then we work our programs to because it identifies the issues and then what needs to get done to address these issues. So we did research, primary research with both girls and boys here in Singapore around the perception of STEM and girls and STEM. So the first and to me, the most important piece of research and finding was it's not a competency issue. Girls are more than competent. Girls are actually, in many instances, very comfortable with STEM subjects. It's a confidence issue. Girls just don't have the confidence. They think that the boys in their class, their the boy counterparts in their class or their school are better suited to STEM. So it's a confidence issue. So it starts there.
Where do you think that comes from though? Is that like, that's social conditioning or?
It's a cultural, social, family issue. And that brings me to point number two. Point number two was this. Girls found that their immediate families weren't as supportive in and encouraging in them taking up STEM. The boys in their households got a lot more encouragement when the boys wanted to take up STEM, either in terms of school subjects or STEM activities, you know, engineering clubs and robotics and things like that outside of school. The boys got more support from family than the girls. So this is, unfortunately, you know, it's a cultural, it's a societal issue. We need to change that mindset. And that's part of the work that we need to do ourselves as an organization. We need to reach out to the parents to educate them, to build the awareness that this is a providing girls with a STEM foundation is a great, great platform for them. And it opens up all these possibilities. So those were the first two. So the third one was that the girls wanted role models. They wanted role models. They wanted have access to other women that also faced challenges but succeeded. They wanted to be inspired by these role models. They wanted mentors, which is why we then developed a mentoring program to give the girls access to these women, so that they could ask these women questions, that they could have somebody to talk to bounce ideas off, right? And to feel like there was somebody who knew what they were going through. So mentoring was critical, which is one of the reasons why we focus so much on mentoring and our mentoring program. The fourth piece of research finding was that there's a sweet spot here in Singapore in terms of age. And we really need to get to the girls and to start to encourage them by about 14 to 15. We have to get to them prior to that. We have to build their confidence up. We have to get them excited. We have to get them motivated and have to get them comfortable with the STEM space. Because after that, if we try to do it, it's a much harder slog to get them motivated and to get them to take up STEM subjects. So that sweet spot before 14 is really where we need to focus our attention. And then after that, once they're in the program, it's about keeping that interest. That's when the corporate visits and the site visits to R&D locations and innovation hubs and the mentoring opportunities and the talks and the webinars, all that keeps them in that space, keeps them interested to ensure that they don't fall off the pipeline in that respect. So those were the key findings. And I think the most recent one was a bit of a shocker to me, actually. Girls associated creativity with the arts. They didn't think STEM was creative. So I think we need to do more to show that, in fact, STEM, engineering, you know, anything tech, it's all about creativity. Innovation, that's all about creative thinking. So that's on us to be able to change that of the girls, to show them that STEM subjects can be extremely creative. Now, data and numbers and can be extremely creative. We know how creative that is in that space. And the application of those skills across industries, that's where the creativity comes about too. So research, critical to the way we think and the way we then set our programming in place.
Yeah, I think that's incredible. I love all the findings. They're really fascinating. And exactly, like once you have the data and you understand, then you can actually then really craft and further the ecosystem and support for these young women. I think that's incredibly exciting what you're doing. And I was curious, you know, how much are you seeing or have you seen a shift doing this with more interest in sustainability and climate change as part of the STEM focus, or it's more sort of traditional tech and engineering and everything that you've shared? Are you seeing like a bit of a shift in the interest?
That shift has started already. we saw the trend. We saw the trend early and we started to move ourselves. But we're seeing the interest come from the girls too, right? That they're it's not just the traditional aspects of STEM, but it's the applications. And there's applications in these areas, as I mentioned earlier, in the environmental space, right? Around clean energy, around climate change, around sustainability, particularly in areas of agriculture, right? And food security. And that obviously it's very much aligned to sustainability too. So I think that's definitely that shift. And we see this trend really just going from strength to strength. This is where it's going to be.
Yeah, that's really exciting. So I wanted to zoom out a little bit and just curious, do you think that within our lifetime, we will see gender equality? Or is it something that's still got a long haul and a long slog ahead?
I wish I could say that I will see it in my lifetime. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think we're going to see it in pockets. I think we're going to see it across certain industries. Certainly, you know, my daughters, I have two daughters in their early 20s. I think they might benefit from it. I think certainly they're going to see numbers move in the right direction. I hope that is the case for them. But I don't think it's going to happen quickly. And I think it's going to be quite a slog to get there. There's still many parts of the world where women are not valued. The work that they do, their contributions, whether it's at home, the workplace, in schools, academically, in the community, and certainly even, you know, at the highest levels of leadership. Women are not appreciated for the value that they bring to the table and their economic contributions.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, thank you for answering. I know it's not an easy question to answer.
Unfortunately, it's one that we live with every day. But, you know, it doesn't stop us from trying. It doesn't stop us from working at it and converting one person at a time. We have, as part of our program, Addressing Domestic Violence, a really interesting new program where it's called Boys Empowered. And so while our focus is obviously women and girls and our very name, United Women Singapore, tells you that we're all about women's empowerment. We're firm believers in male allyship to get there. So to your point about how getting to gender equality, it's not just women fighting the good fight. It's about men also stepping up, supporting, encouraging, and very often clearing the way so that women can succeed. Some of the best mentors that we see, you know, even at board levels, are men. And it's about them becoming good mentors for their mentees and ensuring that they pave the way for women to step up and to demonstrate their capabilities. So we have a boys program, and that's all about starting them younger, educating them, building this awareness and inculcating the sense of understanding that the women in their lives, be it their mothers, aunts, sisters, cousins, have so much value, right? Whether it's at home, whether it's in the workplace again, in the community. And we hope that by doing so, as they grow up, they break that cycle of domestic violence, because they will be that generation of young men who will value their girlfriends, their intimate partners, their wives, and they won't beat up these women in their lives. So to us, this is a critical part of how we address the issue of domestic violence, educating boys.
I think it's actually really interesting to draw the parallels, because I'm more deep in sustainability than in gender and domestic violence. But I see a lot of similarities in the conversation, because a lot of the time when I speak to parents, they're ruled by their children. And when the kids learn about sustainability and climate change and animal the extinction and everything when they're young, they change the whole family dynamics around these issues. And they are the ones that are pushing for change and have a lot of power and a lot of control. And they're brought up differently to realize that these are the pressing, urgent issues of our time. Whereas my generation actually wasn't taught that to the same extent that they are now. And I feel like it's very similar with you saying saying, you know, if we can get, there's a certain age bracket where things get distilled differently, where habits are formed, where understanding of the world is different. And that's really where we need to focus the attention, because they are the future, obviously. And there's a lot of potential to, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for, but like, yeah, really change the generational shifts from a young age.
Absolutely. And to this point, I mean, I think this is where the similarity is even deeper. We see women as being key to sustainability and climate change. So whether it's women who, as you know, for the most part, what 70 to 75% of consumer choices, decision making, household decision making is done by the women folk, right? They're going to decide what they're going to buy, the food that's going to be put on their table. So they're going to decide if this is going to be sustainably acquired, right? Or if this was a result of fair trade, or if this was a result of you know, the supply chain being that of one that was a sustainable supply chain, all those things. Or if in fact it came from a factory somewhere where, you know, there was child labor, right? They're going to make the difference through the knowledge that they have, their understanding, but they're also going to vote with their wallets. And that's going to be, I think, very powerful. And women are in a position to be able to do that, right? And women are going to be the ones that, again, you know, choose everything from the car they drive to the food on the table, where they live, the schools that that kids go to, the activities that the kids do. So the ability to shape and create the sustainability factor within their own families and their communities, I think that's, we can't underestimate that. Women are the ones that, you know, as they start businesses, they will ensure that, again, where's their supply of raw materials? Who are they selling to, right? Are their factories, again, you know, the right type of factories where, you know, workers are in fact treated properly, right? The safety around and the security around these factories, all these things, fair wages. I think that's, if we talk about sustainability, I think it's really hard not to talk about women in the same conversation.
Absolutely. There's so much, especially even the UN with the sustainable development goals, women is such a huge focus for us to be able to achieve the goals and for us to be able to really shift things very quickly.
Women need to be given access. So whether it's education, whether it's the ability to own land and to farm the land, right? The opportunities to start businesses and be encouraged to start businesses. That's where women need these opportunities to thrive. And when they do, they can then, as part of this virtual cycle, also do good, put food on the table, but do so in a manner that's sustainable. And ensure for that next generation. Absolutely. And they will in turn also teach their kids too. Or to your point, maybe the kids are teaching them.
I think it's going to be a combination moving forward. It has to be, you know, we have a small time window where we can turn things around and we can mitigate a lot of the pain and suffering that's going to happen on this planet. So hopefully, yeah, it's amazing the part you're playing in that role. So yeah, really inspiring to hear about everything.
But I think what you say is right. I think the clock is ticking. That's a frightening thought, isn't it? Because there's just that narrow window of opportunity where we need to do it right.
Exactly. I think we're, you know, I got a little jaded last year with the pandemic and with, as I'm sure a lot of people did, around the progress that's really actually happening and people wanting to rush back to normal and everything and not, you know, but I have since shifted and I'm seeing the hope and the light again and seeing really, I guess, just changing what I focus on and seeing all the incredible work that people are doing across so many different sectors and industries and just the ideas and the excitement that's happening. I think there's a lot to be hopeful for. And I haven't given up hope that we won't turn it around in time just yet.
Well, I'm heartened to hear that, Steph. I think that's good. And I think part of it is we need to keep a positive outlook. That's how we overcome and we get back to whatever is the new normal. I hear you when you say last year was a rough year for a lot of people in so many different respects. And you know, there are many people who are still not out of the woods yet still. But you probably saw some pieces and glimmers of hope too, right? We saw that too. I think in some respects, it was an opportunity that women stepped up, right? Very often, you know, we know, so while, you know, I mentioned earlier that the pandemic certainly made it difficult and increased the numbers of, you know, of cases of domestic violence, we also know that there were a lot of women who stepped away and you know, who left abusive families and started life anew, right? Many of them started businesses and they're thriving now today. One of the things that we noticed was the fact that people genuinely wanted to help. We had so many requests of just some of our members, some of our supporters just come to us and go, you know, we don't know where to start. We want to help. What can we do to help? Right? Obviously, yes, we can make a donation. And there were lots of avenues to make donations, you know, the right ones. The government here in Singapore was doing a lot to help a lot of those who had been impacted badly by the pandemic. But there were all these people who just wanted to help. We had people, we had women who came up to us and said, I can bake. Can I organize a bake sale? Can I, you know, get my friends to organize a bake sale? We'll sell our baked goods and confectionery items and we'll make the donation. Right? We had somebody who came up to us and said she has a small business making beautifully exquisite bags. Unique bags, one-of-a-kind bags. And she made a whole collection just for us to be able to sell. And the donate the proceeds, and a huge portion of the proceeds, she wanted to donate. And she made it a point to donate it to one of these women's shelters. Again, to help the women who were, in fact, you know, escaping abusive households, abusive relationships, and who very often had their children with them. So if there was a glimmer of hope, that was it, that there's goodness in people and that push come to shove, they are prepared to step up and be counted and want to do. And in many instances, it's not like these were the tycoons. They were not the millionaires. They were not the billionaires who I'm sure did their part. And I'm sure they did their part. But these were, you know, people who had day jobs, people who were, you know, struggling with stay at home and kids and everything else, but they wanted to help. So maybe that's one of the positives that came out of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's really nice to hear. I wanted to also just kind of reflect, obviously, you've had a very thriving career. So if you were to distill some of the key lessons that you learned over that time as advice to someone, what do you think the key learnings and lessons you would impart?
A few, I think. One of the key things is always be learning, all right? You've got to be, lifelong learning is critical. Never, ever stop. I think when people are working, they tend to, I guess, focus on reading and acquiring knowledge in that industry space. And I one of the things that I would recommend is go beyond. Now, look at other new topics. There's a huge world outside. You might find that something that's going to be your passion at some point. So constantly be looking at new things. So definitely this, you know, be a sponge, absorb everything around you. I think that's really critical. I have something of a 5-point S guide. It starts with S's. So the first one is kind of seek knowledge, be always learning, seek. The second S in my guide is that of support. You support people around you and you seek support. Don't be afraid to seek support. Don't be afraid to ask for help. It takes a very brave person to ask for help. The third one is kind of related to that. It's share. Be ready to share. Be ready to extend that hand. So it's related to support. Be ready to share. And that is both good and the bad. Right, be ready to share even the troubles because somebody will step up and help you. That's my experience. The fourth one is self, actually. I think we're not selfish enough. I think very often we are always, and I say this particularly of women, we're always putting somebody else ahead of us. And I think we need to be occasionally a little selfish. We need to ensure that we take care of ourselves so that we are in better position to help others. Because if we don't look after our own health and our own well-being, and that includes mental well-being and health, we are not in a position to help all those around us who will actually need our help. So that's the fourth S, the self. And the last one, I think you might find this amusing, but that one is sleep. Sleep is so underrated. And you know, certainly while I was working, you know, I was surviving on 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. And while I know that I had a lot of good advice around me saying, no, you need to get more sleep, you need to get more sleep, I just didn't. And I think now I understand that the restorative powers of sleep are so critical. Again, to you know, going back to the self and self-care and looking after the self and being in a position to then, you know, whether it's to tackle the day, it's to help somebody, it's just to go to work, you need to have sleep. So I'm proud to say that I've gone beyond my 4 and 5 hours of sleep now, and I get a few more hours every day, every night. So those would be my five S's. Seek, constantly be seeking. Support all those around you. Share, good and bad. The self, very important. The last one, of course, is sleep. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm so glad I asked. I think they're very simple and very, very important aspects and lessons that I think a lot of us can implement more, especially the sleep and the selfishness. I thought that was great. I really, thank you for sharing the five F's. That's really great. How do you think that we can live wide awake?
What do you mean by wide awake here?
Well, so Live Wide Awake is the name of the podcast. This is a question that I always ask everyone.
Right.
And it's your, whatever your interpretation of it is, you know, what comes up when I ask that? Yeah.
Live passionately. Be interested in everything around you and everybody around you. You know, take the time to get to know everything. Don't sweat the small stuff. Really focus on what's important. You'll learn to prioritize. And don't waste your time on things that don't have any meaning for you. Life is short. I think if anything, the last 18 to 20 months has shown us that we need to really focus on what's important to us and our, you know, whether that's the families, our friends around us, certainly, and the environment is important. Be conscious of that. Live life to the full in that respect, and be kind. Be kind to the people around you. Be kind to yourself. I think that's really important.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for joining and for sharing all the research and your lovely life lessons as well. It was really meaningful. So I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity. And I want to commend you for the work that you are doing in leading the charge and building the awareness of such an important, you know, subject and bringing this to light for so many people. So we need more people like you, Steph, in this world. So thank you.
Thank you. And I could say the exact same thing about you. So thank you for everything that you've done as well.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Georgette. Firstly, education at all levels is key. Ensuring our girls have the confidence and support they need to thrive, but also, very importantly, educating our boys too. Secondly, I loved the five S's: seek knowledge, support, share, self, and sleep. And I really think this is a fantastic checklist. And thirdly, be kind to people around you, but also be kind to yourself.
I'm curious, what did you think about the episode and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steph L. Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.